Support for KOSU comes from listeners just like you, who make a donation in support of the news and the music KOSU brings you. Become a member today and get some cool member benefits. Just click the donate button on kosu.org.
For KOSU News, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. A group known as Oklahomans Decide Healthcare is launching an awareness campaign on its initiative petition to put a Medicaid expansion measure on the ballot in November of 2020. The group still must survive a Supreme Court challenge with oral arguments set for this coming Tuesday. Then supporters would have 90 days to collect 178,000 signatures. Ryan, this seems like a pretty daunting task.
Well, it seems daunting, but if you look, you know, multiple states have done this in the past. I think that we're looking at a very sophisticated campaign operation. Amber England, the sole person on staff right now, has a ton of experience with advocacy building or advocacy coalition building and running statewide campaigns, running legislative campaigns. So they've got, you know, a really steady and experienced hand at the head of this campaign right now. I think that they're going to get these signatures. I think that if the in the event that the oral arguments, you know, derail all or a part of the ballot measure on Tuesday, they've got plenty of time to come back with new language to remedy any problems or concerns that the state Supreme Court has with it. And then they'll go out in the field and they're going to, you know, collect these signatures. I don't think that there's going to be any question as to whether or not they get the signatures and get this on the ballot. I think the bigger question will be, what kind of opposition will there be? Will the opposition be earned media by the governor and others going out and saying, you know, let the legislature fix this, don't do it by ballot measure? Or will there be an actual paid money to opposition to this? That's going to be the real question, because the advocates, they're going to have a lot of money on their side.
Neva.
Well, and I think it may be twofold. I think we may see a situation. The governor has indicated several times that he wants to look at this matter and move with some initiative of his own. I mean, perhaps as early as this fall. And there's been speculation and discussion about the possibility of a special session maybe to come in and deal with just this issue. So I think there are a lot of things still on the table. But the fact that this is such a dividing issue when you really look at rural Oklahoma versus the metropolitan areas. I mean, this is something that I think quickly they understand. I mean, since 2016, one of the things that the coalition has keyed in on is the 8 hospitals that have declared bankruptcy and the 6 that have closed their doors in rural Oklahoma in the last 3 years. I mean, those are things that really get people's attention. And so it's not just the money aspect of how do we get the federal money, what's the price tag attached to it from the state standpoint, but the bigger issue of providing health care and having accessible health care in the outlying parts of the state, which oftentimes lawmakers, when they get together in Oklahoma City, that part of the discussion gets diluted somewhat. So I think it will be interesting to see what the court does next week. And then, as you say, I mean, it's not impossible to get the signatures when you have an issue that has a great deal of emotion and intensity behind it. And we'll just have to see how this proceeds during the summer months.
And it doesn't help that the Commonwealth Fund came out with a report showing Oklahoma as ranks now second worst, and not even close to third worst. I mean, it's Mississippi and us as far as getting access to healthcare.
And, well, that was the, you know, they ranked several things in terms of Oklahoma's healthcare landscape, and the one that was most problematic for the state was access to care. And, you know, Neva's right. This has had a really especially hard-hitting effect on rural Oklahoma. I mean, whenever you're in rural Oklahoma and you're seeing your hospital threatened with bankruptcy, threatened with their doors being closed, and, you know, some communities have already experienced that. You know, there is kind of the rural-urban divide here, but maybe it's not so much a divide as something that could be an issue that transcends that rural-urban divide that we've seen. I mean, in Oklahoma, for the longest time, our political, we talk about politics as rural versus urban, but that's become more and more aligned with, you know, partisan identity as well. So, you know, the rural areas have become more Republican-leaning, urban areas become more Democratic-leaning, and those things that transcended the partisan labels in the years past have kind of faded away. And this may be a new issue that comes to the top that brings Republicans and Democrats in rural areas together around a single issue.
And when you look at the fact that in the legislature, legislature, Republican-dominated legislature, there's been no appetite for really Medicaid expansion. I mean, we've seen this over and over again now in recent years. But as 36 states now have done something with respect to expanding Medicaid, last year voters in three states were successful in approving their Medicaid expansion programs in Utah and Nebraska and Idaho.
Those liberal bastions.
Yes, exactly. I think what we've seen, yeah, I mean, when you look at the sheer numbers, I think it may change the argument and it may change the need for broadening the discussion and trying to find something that I think could be a compromise.
Join the KOSU Business Circle by June 30th and get your small business a year's worth of underwriting for just $400. Email development@kosu.org or call 405-744-9974.
Corrections Director Joe Albaugh is resigning his position. The abrupt announcement came during Wednesday's meeting after the new members took their positions on the Board of Corrections. Neva, any idea what happened?
No, I think it, from all indications, at least from what we know that took place at the meeting, it was something where whatever triggered it, it happened. He made his resignation effective immediately, will retire July 1. I think there was the expectation among many that there very well could be a change at some point in the leadership, given the fact that the governor had not really indicated anything one way or the other. But I think that the real, I think, question was in the statement that Director Albaugh, as he departed, said that they basically there was a difference in philosophy. I mean, there was clearly something as an undercurrent that had precipitated this, kind of quick and very, I think, surprising departure on his part. But, you know, when you look at the broader picture of who comes in long-term to fill this position, I mean, he came in a tough spot 3 years ago and did the things that oftentimes that person gets handed to do, and that was to battle the legislature. He made a lot of folks unhappy, but he was the champion for those folks that do the day-to-day work in the correction system that we know are have to be there, have to be on the job 24/7, 365. And so I think you have to look at the step back and say, you know, let's just don't look at this as an isolated one-time event in a board meeting, but look at the broader context of where this board sees itself, and with the hiring and firing power now of the governor, it may be the beginning of a lot of big changes like this in the future.
Ryan.
And yeah, totally caught everyone flat-footed, the governor included. I mean, mm-hmm. It seemed like they had to call a recess in the middle of the meeting for someone to call the governor and say, this just happened, what do we do? And there was some scrambling there, and ultimately ended up with the appointment of an interim who could be a long-term interim. The interim that they appointed is currently the Director of Operations for the Department of Corrections.
Career man, 30-year plus.
Yeah, decades in the organization or in the state agency. And so at least, you know, there's some continuity there, but there's really no sense of how long they're going to be there. I mean, some of the things that we do know, and speculation here, but some of the things that we can speculate about that seem to be happening is that the governor said that there's going to be a state or a national search for a new director. You know, that seems to indicate to me that as the governor's been looking at whether or not to rehire Director Albaugh, they haven't been really, you know, testing a lot of the other waters, or maybe they have, but that search process didn't really seem to be that far along because they're instituting something now with an interim. If you'd had a hiring process, you'd think you would have heard some announcement that they are just expediting that. But now,
like
they're
going, what happened with DHS.
Yeah, now they're going on a search. And so, you know, that's going to be really important to bring somebody in, I think, that will tell the truth like Director Albaugh has done. I mean, that's been incredibly important for him to be an advocate for correctional officers. He's been one of the biggest champions for correctional officers the state's ever seen. And, you know, to see him go, whoever replaces him, he or she needs to step up and be an advocate for them, but also to follow with this board, to work with this board, to put in criminal justice reform measures, to be an advocate in front of the legislature, and to really look at investing in programs rather than just trying to grow the prison system. And we're looking at a system, we're looking at a search. Who wants to take over this agency? I mean, it's crumbling. It is the Titanic. And, you know, rather than, we don't need to just add more deck chairs to the deck. We need to figure out how to reduce the size of the ship.
Well, one of the things, you know, Abba said in the meeting is he said he thought he was working with the governor and then made the statement, but apparently I wasn't. I think there were a lot of things apparently kind of brewing in the background on this that just all hit at once. And I think as we see this kind of settle out, I think we'll begin to, you know, see the rest of the picture.
Yeah.
And we may see where this board seems to be charged, and with the five that the governor personally interviewed, he said, and made his selections, they clearly, with one of those five being now the new chair, I mean, they're clearly in charge and going to obviously be very hands-on, which has been something different than we've seen on many of these boards and commissions in the past.
And when Joe Alba took this job, he didn't take this job because he needed the job. I mean, this right. He has one of the most storied political and public service careers in the state of Oklahoma's history. And so when he took this job, it was, I think, out of a sense of public service, and he threw himself into it. I mean, you talk to corrections folks, I'll tell you, you could see him regularly on the yards in correctional facilities around the state talking to inmates, you know, knew a lot of them by first name, and he really threw himself into this job. And I think whatever that story emerges over the next couple of weeks of what actually happened here, what we're going to see is that Joe Alba just didn't need it. And he said, okay, I've done what I can do, and I'm going to walk away from this and go retire. I doubt that he's going to stay retired for long. He's going to do something else.
And clearly, with each of these directors of these major agencies, as well as the cabinet secretaries, what we have is a governor who very clearly seems to be making appointments and selections based upon a chemistry of someone that he really has a rapport with, philosophically is aligned with, whatever that combination, you know, that kind of perfect chemistry mix that comes into play. It is significant when you have the CEO type philosophy of these, you have one person making this selection, it does become part of the total equation. So it may be nothing more than kind of some of that mix as opposed to just something that's the broader philosophical criminal justice and bigger issues that are on the forefront for corrections.
Yeah.
Support for KOSU comes from listeners just like you, who make a donation in support of the news and the music KOSU brings you. Become a member today and get some cool member benefits. Just click the donate button on kosu.org.
The Pardon and Parole Board discusses implementation of House Bill 1269. The measure, passed by lawmakers and signed by Governor Stitt, makes State Question 780 retroactive, resulting in the reduced sentences for several nonviolent offenders already serving time. In fact, supporters say 623 people could get early release by the time HB 1269 takes effect in November. Ryan, how big of a deal is this for Oklahoma's high incarceration rate?
It's a huge deal. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of talk about things that were left on the table at the end of this legislative session with regard to criminal justice reform, and that's true. And I think that we can all recognize the need to redouble our efforts to get those things passed next year. But what happened with the passage of House Bill 1269 is really remarkable. I mean, it's a remarkable step forward in looking back at some of our past mistakes and trying to rectify them and getting these folks out of prison. And then for people that are already out of prison that still have these charges hanging over their head, the ability to go back and get those expunged so that they can move on with their lives, get student loans, get housing, get jobs. I mean, this is a real important piece of legislation. I will say that the Pardon and Parole Board right now is really trying to figure out process and bandwidth. And, you know, like you said, the bill doesn't go into effect until November, but there's a lot that they need to be doing right now so that as soon as the bill becomes effective, we're not looking at months of implementation. We can start that implementation now so that whenever it becomes effective in November, we can begin to get these folks out of prison and get folks' records expunged. Now, I will say that the original version of the bill would have put all of these mechanisms in district courts around the state of Oklahoma, and I think would have streamlined that process. You know, now we're looking at a pardon and parole board that's really a part-time board, having to process a lot of this stuff. I think that they're up to the task, and there are a lot of organizations that are ready to help them with this. But you know, the original version of the bill, I think, would have made this implementation process a heck of a lot smoother.
Still, it's nice to see the board kind of being a little more proactive.
Absolutely. And I think in terms of numbers, I mean, you mentioned the 623. I think there are two other categories that fold into this, and that number is somewhere around 1,500 additional. So, I mean, you're looking at significant numbers, and I think the push is, rather than wait till November 1, I mean, is to be prepared so that on November 1, that those things can immediately take place and these folks are released, or at least that seems to be the conversation yeah. that's at the forefront. I think the other thing is, I mean, you have a pardon and parole board that is looking at its second commutation docket. A lot goes into that, putting that into the works. So, I mean, it's no longer a board. I mean, as you say, Ryan, that it's a situation where it becomes almost a full-time, part-time, service yeah. to the state if you're on this board and commission. So I think they're going to have to look at, from a budget standpoint, what are they going to do to help make this thing work mechanically and streamline it, as you say, and come back next year, I'm sure, with a lot of other pieces of legislation that will directly, tie back to this and other areas in the criminal justice area.
Well, on the numbers point, I mean, so we got, 600 or so folks that mm-hmm. could be released. If you add in people that have sentence enhancements that are based upon old felony charges that are now misdemeanors, that number goes to over 1,000. But then tens of thousands of Oklahomans that are no longer incarcerated or under any sort of supervision, but still have these felony records.
Which makes it difficult to get jobs.
The numbers here and the number of people that are impacted are huge. Mm-hmm. The thing that I would say is that I would ask people to think about criminal justice reform as prospective and retrospective. And this is a retrospective application. We're trying to clean up our old mess. This isn't sentencing reform the way that State Question 780 was. State Question 780 was forward-looking. This is backward-looking and trying to clean up the mess pre-State Question 780. And that's what we're looking at the legislature right now. It's oftentimes easier to go back and clean up old messes because we have direct evidence of what that looks like. Mm-hmm. It's a lot harder on things like sentencing reform and modifying the way that we treat people coming into the system, because that's forward-looking, and I think lawmakers are a little bit more suspective of the political liability that they perceive to exist with those prospective reforms. But those are the ones that are going to be most important. We're not going to get ourselves out of this hole by looking backwards and releasing folks. We've got to start changing the way that we do business.
Join the KOSU Business Circle by June 30th and get your small business a year's worth of underwriting for just $400. Email development@kosu.org or call 405-744-9974.
Oklahoma County's Jail Trust meets for its first time. The 9 members elected new leadership and heard about structural issues plaguing the facility. The trust was created to repair the jail's damaged reputation. Neva, can this group do it?
Well, I think this group has an extraordinary opportunity. And when you look at the composition of the group, I mean, you have folks on there that are very civic-minded, community-minded, people that have a great deal of expertise and understanding of the issue directly and indirectly. So I think with the leadership of Tricia Everest and Jim Couch leading this, I mean, clearly you have folks that this isn't their first rodeo, so to speak. I mean, they know what they're getting into and what they need to look at, and clearly are going to be very aggressive and very proactive in wanting information to make good decisions. There are going to be these continued feuds, for lack of a better description, between the sheriff and the trust. I mean, what his perspective of what is really needed versus theirs in the broader picture. The conversation still: do we need a new jail? Do we do what we need to do with the existing jail? There are a lot of big issues and a lot of price tag issues attached to it. Just like the engineer came and had the conversation in that first meeting, saying, "Look, yes, we've looked at this over and over again. We have these big issues, and with every one of them, there's a big price tag attached to it. If you're talking about just dealing with the existing and trying to improve on it, so this will be, I think, a trust that will be heavily." Heavily watched by a broad group of people on all sides, because it's a time where action has really got to take place. It's the political dimension is only one aspect of this in public safety, but it's the broader picture long term of what this does in the life of the city and the county.
And I'm sure it also helps that this is an open public meeting. So yeah. Instead of an engineer going to the sheriff in his office and telling him what's going on, this is a public meeting where transparency, we get to see what's actually going on.
Yeah, I mean, you see people, you know, live tweeting this event, and you know, you can really be there and be in the room, and that's incredibly important. I'm optimistic about what this trust can accomplish. I think that, you know, Tricia Everest is incredibly engaged on the criminal justice reform movement in Oklahoma. She, I think, understands a lot of what's happening in Oklahoma County. I think that she understands the political dimensions here. And so I'm optimistic about what they can do. I want to, just for our listeners, you know, we've talked about this in the past, jails versus prisons, right? So prison is where you go after you're convicted. Jail, you know, most of the people sitting in county jails around the state of Oklahoma, the overwhelming majority of those folks have yet to be convicted of anything. They're pretrial detainees. You know, they are there awaiting trial or awaiting, you know, some sort of a plea deal. And so that's what happens if you get arrested and you don't have the money to bail out. You sit in that jail, and that gives prosecutors an enormous amount of leverage over you. So I think that when we look at the Oklahoma County Jail and we hear these problems about mold, when we hear problems about jail deaths and illness in the jails and the unsafe working conditions for the officers that are there, we're talking about people that are innocent. I mean, that's this huge cornerstone of the American criminal justice system, is that you are innocent until you're proven guilty. I've walked through the Oklahoma County Jail. I've been in other county jails around the state of Oklahoma. We dehumanize these people that are presumed innocent. We shouldn't dehumanize people even in prison, but especially folks that are presumed innocent. We treat them like animals in these places. And we've really got to think not just about how do we make the jail operate better, but I hope that this jail trust will engage on criminal justice reform policies that prevent people from going into that jail unnecessarily in the first place. You know, when we talk about mental health treatment, a homeless service for people that are homeless, right now that jail serves as a repository for a lot of people that are there only because they don't have the money to pay, or because they have a mental illness, or because they're homeless, or all three.
And that's another the mental health component. Yeah. I mean, with these many of these detainees, and one of the conversations with MAPS4 is the possibility of including some type of mental health facility that where we could actually see these inmates diverted from the county jail into a mental health facility of some sort. So there are some very innovative ideas, I think, on the table being discussed, and it's a question of will the city put that as part of their next sales tax initiative, fold that into the mix, which could have great implications for the county jail.
Yeah.
Support for KOSU comes from listeners just like you, who make a donation in support of the news and the music KOSU brings you. Become a member today and get some cool member benefits. Just click the donate button on kosu.org.
Oklahoma Democrats select their first African-American woman to run the state party. After a bit of confusion and a close vote, Tulsa realtor Alicia Andrews was selected as the chair for the Democratic Party. Ryan, what do you know of Alicia Andrews?
You know, she's been secretary of the party for a couple of years now, somebody who just got interested and started volunteering. And one of those things that happens in politics is that if you start volunteering,
you move up.
And you show up on a
rate. You get more responsibility.
That's right. If you show up, it also works. The converse of that is true as well. If you don't show up, you will get nominated for something.
That's true, yes.
And you won't be paid for it.
And you won't be paid for it. Well, you'll be paid in a lot of grief. You'll be paid in a lot of grief. So I think that it was historic that the Democratic Party, I mean, it shouldn't be historic as Alicia Andrews said. That's what she said.
And it's 2019.
It's totally true. But 2019, it shouldn't be historic, but it is. But we had three African-American women running for chair of the Oklahoma Democratic Party. One ultimately bowed out of the race early on. And then we had, you know, two contenders, an incredibly close vote. There was a lot of chaos with regard to the vote, but it's the Oklahoma Democratic Party. And these party conventions on both sides are always tough. And you've got a lot of, you know, good faith volunteers administering a very complicated election system. And sometimes things go wrong and you have to hit the pause button and come back the next morning to certify the election results. But I feel like the party is going to come together here around Alicia. And, you know, this is an important moment for the state party. I will say that there's just the mechanics of the way the party works is that oftentimes the person that's elected chair also becomes the executive director of the party. And so the executive director is a paid staff member who manages the day-to-day operations of the state party. Not only is the new chair not going to serve as the executive director, but the state party made the decision that they were going to create a rule that would disallow that from happening in the future. So Anastasia Langhorne, who is the outgoing Democratic Party chair, and congratulations to her, and one of the youngest party chairs in the country, and really oversaw some remarkable things, including the flipping of the 5th congressional district in Oklahoma. Her tenure there, you know, she's got a solid track record and legacy that she's leaving behind, but she served as both. And so that's going to be the last of that, at least for the time being. It'll be interesting to see how that works out with the party and who ultimately is hired as the executive director.
Neva.
And it is interesting that both the Republicans and the Democrats in their party structure now have chairs from Tulsa County. And yes. I don't recall in recent memory that ever being the case. I mean, you have the new Democratic Party chair, and then David McLean of Skytook is the new newly elected Republican Party chair less than a month or so ago. So new folks at the helm in both parties coming up on a very big presidential year, 2020, as well as all of the legislative races that will, you know, have a lot of attention focused on, and the 5th district race, which clearly is going to be one that's going to get a lot of national attention. So I think that these folks have a lot on their plate, and it'll be interesting times for both parties to see what they can do to energize their folks and develop an apparatus on both sides to be able to marshal not only the troops, so to speak, but also the money. And I think that's been a struggling issue with parties across the country in recent years, is with independent expenditures and folks kind of going out and doing their own thing, the parties have struggled to kind of be the driving force in states in these big elections.
So who will be the executive director?
Who knows? I mean, because Anastasia Langthorne is gone. You know, she's going to be Carrie Blumert's communications director, the Oklahoma County Commissioner, okay. Carrie Blumert. So she's moving out of the party entirely. I think that there's a big question mark as to who that is. And, you know, what we've seen in other state parties is that they've done a national search. I mean, right. they bring in a professional.
Bring in folks from
D.C. that have done this, because, as Neva said, the money aspect of this gets really complicated. Parties, there's a question of, you know, what's the role of parties, especially when you've got independent expenditures, you've got these PACs that do a lot of the things that parties used to do. Mm-hmm. Parties are a conduit for national political money. And so, you know, they're going to see them as a tool, as part of a larger toolbox of funding TV, funding canvassers, especially with the presidential year. Having somebody that knows exactly how those things work, so that one, things work, and two, people don't get in trouble and run afoul of the law, even inadvertently or unintentionally, that's really important.
Because the state party deals not only with state ethics issues, but also federal election right. commission issues and the various funds that they have and use and all of that reporting. So it's a far more daunting challenge, I think, than people sometimes look at when they think that this is just a bunch of volunteers and they just kind of do whatever they do. It is a big business that has to be run like a business. And oftentimes these executive directors, the ones that do well, are the people that know the ropes and can come in and hit the ground running.
Well, and both the Republican and Democratic Party chairs and new executive directors, they're going to oversee delegate selection to national conventions yeah. coming up next year. You know, if you talk to either party, I think that chairs and executive directors that have been through that delegate selection process and the convention process will tell you that it's one of the most fun and exciting times of their life, but one of the most difficult things that they've ever done politically.
Absolutely.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.